Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The campaign of John Fetterman for a Senate seat from Pennsylvania has produced truly disturbing, ableist discourses about the qualification of people with disabilities. We explore this debate. And first, Brazil's election of Lula da Silva over Bolsonaro has provided hope that the country will retain its democratic institutions. We discuss the elections and the likely policy changes.
I'm Doug Becker. Following an intense and emotional campaign, Brazil's former president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, always just known as Lula, defeated incumbent president Jair Bolsonaro in the presidential election in Brazil this past Sunday, October 30th. The election was extremely close, contrary to some of the initial polls. As we record this show, Bolsonaro has not conceded the election and has said very little about the future, about the election. On today's show, we will explore these election results and the future of Brazil, policy changes that are likely to occur with the installation of Lula as president, and the future of democratic institutions on a country whose partisanship has frayed many of these institutions. Our guests today are Erica Resende, Assistant Professor of International Relations and Security Studies at the Brazilian National War College in Rio de Janeiro. She is the co-editor of Memory and Trauma in International Relations, Theories, Cases, and Debates, and Crisis and Change in Post-Cold War Global Politics. And Fernanda Magnotta, Professor of International Relations at Fundação Armando Alvarez Penteado, or FAAP, a columnist in international politics at the Universo Online, UOL, and also visiting faculty Fulbright Scholar at the University of Southern California. She is the author of Ideas Matter, American Exceptionalism at the Dawn of a Superpower, and numerous op-ed pieces for UOL, including the very recent If He Loses the Election, Bolsonaro is Expected to Follow Trumpist Protocol. Thank you both very, very much for joining us. Erica, I will start with you with a question. This election on Sunday was considerably closer, was rather nerve-wracking, I imagine, for you in Rio de Janeiro. Why did the election turn out the way that it did? And was it surprising that it was this close?
Well, the polls have been announcing already a story that the elections will be very, very close. Around 4% of difference between the candidates, 4 to 3%. What actually happened is that Bolsonaro needed around 8 million extra votes, secure the ones that he got in the first round, and then got an additional 8 million. And Lula needed about an additional 2 million votes. And translating that into the numbers from all the running candidates, that meant that Lula had to secure about 25% of votes that went in the first round to different candidates, especially from the so-called third way, which was an attempt to break the polarization between candidates. The only female candidate, Simone Tebet, and Ciro Gomes, another traditional politician on his third or fourth attempt for the presidential race. So Lula had to secure at least 22-25% of the votes. Those votes, while Bolsonaro had to reach out and claim at least 80%, 85%. And what happened in election day, at the end of the day, Bolsonaro got around 58 million, about 58, and Lula 60 million votes. So the difference between them was 2.1 million votes, translating to 1.8% of difference. So very, very close. I think it was only very, look into how Brazilians we do adopt the electoral voting machine. So that means that it's a very fast solution to find out, okay, who won. So usually polling voting booths closed at 5, although everybody who is still in the line was still allowed to vote. But roughly around 8:30, 9 p.m., usually we already are informed of the winner. This time, for us, an eternity, it took about 2.5 hours to eventually Lula to be projected as the winner, because mathematically he wouldn't, Bolsonaro would not be able to surpass Lula, taking into account the remaining uncounted votes out there. So it was 2.5 hours of anxiety, especially because, and this I think it's very similar to the US experience. The votes come in from the south up north. Usually, so in the south, Bolsonaro has the majority of votes. So he starts on like the first taking off. And it usually only wants about 50% of the vote from the northeast part of Brazil comes down, is that Lula starts to be pushed forward and then was able to take the lead. But eventually about 2.5 hours already in the voting, Lula was projected a winner. And one thing, maybe I'm also anticipating your next question, we had a very unique, unusual event going on with lack of public transportation and blockage implemented by the federal patrolling police. Very unusual, this police force, the federal police force in charge of supervising and patrolling federal highways. And they decided at 7 a.m. in the morning, through a coordinated multiple operation of multiple agents and throughout, predominantly in the northeast part of Brazil, where Lula was way ahead in the polls in a difference of 70% against 30% for Bolsonaro. And they started stopping public transportation on buses to check their documents. And in a way, what happened is that voters sometimes had to wait until like 3 hours trying to get on buses to go vote. No bus public transportation was available. And people were sitting in traffic jams, waiting in the roads to be cleared. That did have an impact, but the estimate was around 20,000 voters had trouble or were not able to reach the voting sections in time. But if you count into the overall, it was a very small impact and it did not actually cause, was not so harmful. That was the logic behind the Supreme Electoral Court that decided therefore not to extend the voting time. Mm. It was asked of them, but decided not because the impact had been very marginal. But still, it was, I think, a very desperate attempt targeting the parts of Brazil, the northeast states, where Lula was way, way ahead. When I mentioned 70 against 30, right. For and the worst thing of it, it also tells you how police forces, as well as the armed forces, have been highly taken over, contaminated by the populist logic, so to speak, of creating and strengthening the polarization in the communities.
So it sounds like it was the stories about voter suppression were less, it had less of a direct impact on the numbers, but it certainly has contributed to the emotions, to the fraying, to the response within the country. I want to turn to Fernanda. now, because I know you've written about how this is kind of the similarities with the United States. And we know that President Bolsonaro was indicating a lack of faith in the voting mechanisms. The vote was going to be stolen, was going to be, you know, was rigged, et cetera. And then the vote turned out this close. How much have we seen those allegations that the vote was not necessarily an accurate vote? And how much can we perhaps anticipate more of that coming from Bolsonaro and Bolsonaro's allies?
Hey, Doug, thank you for your invitation. It's a pleasure to be here and to share this show with Erica, who is a very good friend of mine. I was missing her a lot. And well, this is a very good question. And I would just like to add something to what Erica just said, because to understand this attempt of questioning the votes and the ballots and the system, we need to understand how close, polarized, and unique this election was in so many ways. It is very important to mention that besides the suppression that we were discussing here, it is also very important to say that the government machine was very used until the last minute to favor Bolsonaro. Thousands of millions of reais that were spent to make it much more eligible. And also there is not just a conservative movement in Brazil that is very relevant, of course, but also there is an anti-PTism, as we say, because of the name of Lula's party, the PT, Workers' Party in English. So this anti-PTism is very strong since Lula was accused of corruption in the past, and it was very used as part of this narrative to talk about frauds and try to convince people that Lula would not run for president again. It is also important to say that Lula will be the first Brazilian president since our redemocratization to return to power for a third term. So that is, this is very special. And also, and that's why I'm making this introduction here, Bolsonaro is the first to lose a re-election in the Brazilian recent history. So we're talking about a government that has made a lot of resentment and that mobilized fears of people very often. So it's not something that we cannot forget. Bolsonaro remained silent during almost 48 hours after the results went public. So he was not accepting to speak with many people, just with some few allies. And recently he came in public because we all know in the political parties and also in the judiciary, there were lots of pressure. So Bolsonaro had to recognize he has been defeated. His speech took around 2 minutes. And during these 2 minutes, he didn't recognize the victory of the adversary. He didn't mention the name of the adversary. And he didn't say anything special regarding the elections itself. He just said that he would not reinforce some protests that are happening in the country, especially involving some truck drivers. He also said that he understands the feeling of these people because these people somehow are not satisfied with what happened in the elections. And also he said that he would do everything considering what is written in our constitution. That's what he said. It was very vague and it was very open to what we could understand as our interests can move people. So we have in one side, many politicians and people from the press, for example, saying it was not sufficient because he was not very clear and very straightforward. It was necessary him to be much more open about everything. He was not, but at the same time, it was his way to saying that he will not discuss the results. He was not open to that. It is very important because during the electoral process, as you said, he sometimes acted very similarly to what Trump did in the US. So we all were expecting something that would say, I would say, would be an attempt to deny the results. So we were waiting for factoids. We were waiting for allegations that the elections were rigged, that he would not recognize the official results. We were waiting him to say that he is suffering political persecution, especially by the justice. Of course, relying on this information via social media to mobilize groups, to cause protests, intimidation, public mobilizations. And of course, everybody was waiting him to seek support inside and outside the country to reinforce this idea of conspiracy. So a very big conspiracy from the system against him. But all of that would depend on how the Brazilian forces would behave and how the international community would behave as well. And these both players, they, I think, somehow isolated Bolsonaro. The president of the chamber greeted the president-elect Lula in the first minutes later than the election. Many conservative politicians indirectly did that as well, saying that they would be opposition to the new president, including some former ministers from Bolsonaro, as the environment minister, Ricardo Salles, or even Sergio Moro, the former minister of justice. So Bolsonaro became very isolated with such many leaders saying things like that. And in the international field, just to close, dozens of leaders have already recognized Lula's victory and sent many validating messages, somehow saying that the election result was fair. So that's why, in my opinion, it would become very difficult for Bolsonaro now to deny the results and not to respect the protocols, Doug.
It's notable. This was reminded, you know, to me by a colleague about how unique in world history that one of the first, or at least in American history, that one of the first international leaders to recognize Lula was President Biden, who offered his congratulations. And the question, when was the last time an American president quickly stepped in to recognize a Marxist leader elected in Latin America against a rightist strongman? So something has certainly changed in American foreign policy in Latin America. You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the Brazilian election with Erica Resende and Fernanda Magnotta. So at this point, I'd like to shift and think about what's going to change? What kind of policies might change in Brazil with the installation of Lula as a president? And Erica, we all have recognized this unique position in Brazilian history of a president returning. So we have a pretty good record of how Lula will govern because he had governed, you know, for a number of years prior to that. There's some areas where he seems to be even more changed. So one is on environmental protection, that Lula campaigned, I understand, on perhaps the greenest campaign of any major Brazilian presidential candidate, would seem to be very committed to Amazonian protection, returning Brazil to a number of green campaigns. Can we expect that a Lula government is going to be even greener than perhaps, you know, the way he governed 10 years ago?
Well, first of all, just to make things a little clear, more of a clear picture for U.S. audiences. Yes, Lula comes from the Workers' Party, a leftist political party, but make no mistake, he has been elected as a symbol of democratic forces. And he has been, since from the launching of his name as a candidate, making it clear that his government will be more to the center than to the left. And he had to do so to be able, so that he would be able to gain political support. And he presented himself and was embraced as such, recognized as such, as a symbol of democratization. So it was not by chance that one expression continuously used by the press, by analysts, was a broad front. The same expression has only been employed in 1982-84, when Brazil started a political campaign, a massive, you know, mobilization towards the return to democracy, for redemocratization. So the idea, I think, the use of this language, a broad front, democratic forces, is that this is this moment is going to inaugurate a different new republic after 4 years of complete disruption, destruction of the Brazilian state system, of Brazilian state. So the first thing to be clear is that this administration, the upcoming administration, will not be a repeat of his previous two administrations. It will be much more on the center. And hence, his vice president, a former political adversary, but who also represented those middle ground forces, Geraldo Alckmin. And then going to, especially, you know, the policies and the issues. Well, first of all, I think for the next 2 years, the first step will be a major rebuilding of the Brazilian state. And when I say rebuilding, it's actually trying to undo the damage that this current administration has done. And that has to do with how state agencies, bureaucracies had all been torn down into pieces, occupied by ideological allies. And so all the money that had been cut off from the budget of those agencies and structures, that everything had completely disappeared and dismantled in the last 4 years. So I would encourage people not to expect that magic's going to happen, especially for regarding environmental policies, due to the huge destruction that was implemented. Just to give an idea, over 35% of all environmentalist personnel that were civil servants and hired by the federal government to work in the project, they decided to just go away. So either they, if able, they retired, or they switched careers and left. So even if you wanted to make huge changes, there's nothing actually to work on to make those changes. A third element, and Fernanda mentioned the state machine, that the government machine that was used in the last 6 months. The current budget proposal for 23, it's completely unrealistic. There is absolutely just no money left. And the spending has been so huge to be able to afford all those benefits that had been broadly distributed to be able to get votes, especially from the poor segment. And so the dealing with the budget and the regard, all the discussion that has to do with budget for next year, this will be a major obstacle to any broad, substantive policy change. So I think that not in terms of policy, but Lula will give signs and he will act symbolically. This is not this why I think the nomination, the members of his cabinet will have a significant, important role, symbolic role, into sending out clear messages. We might not be able to do this immediately in the first or 2 years, but this is the way we're going.
And Fernanda, another huge obstacle is a rather hostile Congress, correct? And Bolsonaro's party and his allies did quite well in congressional elections. So I would imagine there would be quite a bit of political battling between the president and Congress.
Yeah, Doug, you're right. Bolsonarism, as Trumpism here in the US, comes out of this election very, very strong. It lost, of course, its leaders because Bolsonaro will not be the president, and also the control of part of this public machine we are referring, of course. But this far-right movement could elect most of the leaders in Brazil, governors, including three of the most important states of the nation, such as São Paulo, Rio, and Minas Gerais, and also many representatives and senators, including, of course, several former ministers of Bolsonaro, who will be there in opposition, a direct opposition to Lula. So we're going to have one of the most conservative Congress in our history. Lula, of course, will need to negotiate to make lots of concessions in order to govern, as Erica was just saying. So these allies outside from the left, they will be very, very important. And something else that is important to mention here, and so I think this sometimes can be a little bit different from what you have here in the US. In Brazil, we have around 35 political parties, around 30 of them represented in the Congress. So sometimes, or always, to be much more precise, to govern, you need to build coalitions. And we have these parties, what we call in the Brazil, in the Brazilian Portuguese, Centrão. It is a coalition full of parties from the center, as the word suggests. And the idea is to be able to govern in Brazil, you need to build these coalitions with these politicians. And something that is very interesting for me, and I think for other analysts in Brazil, is that we need a little bit more time to understand exactly what's the size of Bolsonarism, because it's not clear how many allies are with Bolsonaro because Bolsonaro is in power, and how many of them are with Bolsonaro because they really agree on what Bolsonaro represents. So in my opinion, there will be a discussion between conviction and convenience. So we're not sure if Bolsonarism is as big as it seems. Of course, it's big. Of course, it's relevant. Of course, it will remain over the next years. Of course, it will cause problems to Lula to govern. But I'm not sure if it's that big, because we had many signs in the last 48 hours that many of these leaders are very flexible and they can change sizes. So, as happened in the past as well, many of the Bolsonarists nowadays were from the Workers' Party or supporters for Lula in the past. It's very crazy. So, I completely agree with what Erica just said. It will be very tough to govern Brazil. It will be very complicated. I remember that American president that in the past said that he was trying to return the US to normalcy. I always remember this word he created. Somehow is what Lula is supposed to do, to bring back normalcy. But we're not sure if it's possible because, you know, we have a very conservative, polarized society. We don't have, as we had in the beginning of the 2000s, the commodities boom that Lula favored off in the beginning of his first mandate. We don't have the same macroeconomic stability that he had in this moment. We have a very complicated fiscal situation, as Erica mentioned. And of course, we have the international scenario, including the remaining aspects of the pandemic, inflation in the developed countries. We have the war in Ukraine. All of that will affect Brazil's capacity to grow. So it will be very tough for Lula. And that's why I think we need to be very vigilant about what's going to happen in the next 4 years.
Yeah. And Erica, you want to respond as well?
Yes, this is all true that Fernanda has been telling us. But one thing that we have to be happy about, Fernanda, especially you and I who work with foreign policy, our research object has just came back from the grave because finally we have, you know, an incoming president that now actually talks about foreign policy. So that makes us happy. Like Lula in his acceptance speech on Sunday evening, he went on to talk about South America, Latin America, international engagements, multilateralism, coalitions and alliances, a vocabulary that had been absolutely absent from presidential discourse in 4 years.
And if I can follow that up, Erica, I know that Bolsonaro had seen a fracturing of regional relations, you know, the close ties there, but we're experiencing in Latin America what, you know, I always hear is described as the pink wave, this wave of center or leftist and left of center types of government. So should we expect a greater cooperation between Brazil and many of its neighbors that share at least broadly interests in questions of Latin American integration and greater cooperation?
All of our neighbors send messages in the first hour of not even the formal declaration of the win, but the projection by the polls that Lula's going to win. So within the first hour of the projection of the win, leaders of Argentina, Chile, and Colombia were already calling and giving congratulations. And I'm 51, I'm about to be 52 years old. First time ever in my life, the president of Argentina flew to Brazil yesterday morning to personally meet with Lula. In the early hours, they had breakfast together yesterday. I have never seen such a show of a demonstration of support, and we're ready. We are so happy that you won. Argentinians were relieved that you won. And we are looking forward to start building back South America integration movement again after 4 years. So I have never seen that demonstration so plain. That's why I think, especially in the first year of the government, because of those constraints, fiscal, economics, and war in Ukraine, and et cetera, it's going on. So the first year of Lula administration will be a year of symbolic gestures, sending out a message, give us a little time, we're getting there.
Yeah, and Brazilian leadership, so essential in integration in the region, the size of the country, the importance of the country. Fernanda, we've only got a couple of minutes left, but there's one other issue that I want to make sure to raise, and I'll raise it with you. Like the United States, one thing that Lula shares in common with Biden is that he is not a young man. Even in his acceptance speech, he made references, you know, potentially to, you know, to health issues. I think his line was that if my heart stops, yours will continue on. Are we expected this is likely one term? And I would imagine many Brazilian leaders are already positioning themselves to be the replacement. How much is that going to complicate Lula's governance?
Yes, Doug. Probably he will be a president of one term. He said that many times. And of course, it's his third mandate as well. So we're not waiting for a fourth one to come. Probably this will be much more clear during the next years. Will depend on who will be his ministers and how this right movement will organize itself as well. We're not sure about the size of Bolsonarism, as I said. We're not sure about what's going to happen with this opposition leaders, such as the president Bolsonaro himself, because we know he will face many charges. We're not sure if he will be able to run as candidate again in 2026. So I would say that these variables are very relevant to make sure of who is coming next. Maybe in the political party that Lula belongs, they have some names such as they used in the past, Fernando Haddad, for example, who was a mayor of Sao Paulo, minister of education, now He was a very strong supporter of Lula. He ran from presidency in 2018 against Bolsonaro. He lost in the second round. So it's always a strong name inside the party, but I don't see as a very competitive at this moment, especially considering this anti-PT movement that we have here and the need to another coalition such as this left-right, left-center, left-something more able to include these people from the democratic right. Because now this is the question in Brazil, what will be of the democratic right? Because of course we have a right wing, this is not a problem, but now we have this far right wing and it's somehow disputing with the traditional right. So these are the questions we need to answer before to have a name. Many people in Brazil believe that another candidate such as Simone Tabet, that Erica mentioned in the beginning, would be very competitive because she was opposition for Bolsonaro. She was opposition of Lula as well. She is from the central area of Brazil, very connected to the commodities producers, etc. She's from this center right I was referring, and she embraced and supported Lula during the second round because it was a democratic group all against Bolsonaro. So many people would bet that she's a good name. We're not sure if she will be that strong in 4 years ahead. So let's see.
And with that, no matter what, Brazilians certainly seem to be in a very festive mood considering what was at stake in this election. And to keep in mind that regardless of what the next 4 years hold, it seemingly more committed to democracy, more committed to engagement. And perhaps this is yet a dawn of a continued new day in Brazilian democracy. I see the smiles on faces and recognize that this is a time to celebrate for many Brazilians. We've been discussing the Brazilian election of Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, or Lula, over Jair Bolsonaro, and the continuation of democracy in Brazil after a very tense election, very emotional election this past Sunday. Our guests today have been Erica Resende, Assistant Professor of International Relations and Security Studies at the Brazilian National War College in Rio de Janeiro. She's the co-editor of Memory and Trauma in International Relations, Theories, Cases, and Debates, and Crisis and Change in Post-Cold War Global Politics, and others coming forward, including one that I will be collaborating with her on in the very near future. And Fernanda Magnota, Professor of International Relations at Fundação Armando Alvarez Penteado, FAAP. She's also a columnist for international politics for the Universo Online, a wonderful follow for several op-eds on numerous issues, and also a visiting faculty Fulbright scholar at the University of Southern California. She's the author of Ideas Matter, American Exceptionalism at the Dawn of the Superpower, and numerous op-ed pieces, including If He Loses the Election, Bolsonaro is expected to follow Trumpist protocol. Thank you both very much for joining us.
When we come back, does John Fetterman's stroke mean he should be disqualified from serving in the U.S. Senate? What does this mean for persons with disabilities and their capabilities as elected officials? Stay with us. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. What are the latent messages in the dominant narratives and frames about the debates between John Fetterman and Mehmet Oz, who are running for a Senate seat in Pennsylvania? And what does this framing say about the rights and abilities of people with disabilities in the United States? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. The narrative of John Fetterman in his campaign against Mehmet Oz for a Senate seat in Pennsylvania has centered on the stroke he suffered as he was winning the Democratic nomination. The debate they held then focused almost exclusively on the accommodations he requested and the physical challenges he faced during the debate. Is this message suggesting that persons with disabilities are unqualified to serve in elected office? How is this ableist narrative framing the narratives about the rights and abilities of persons with disabilities in the United States? Our guest today is Damian Patrick Williams, assistant professor in philosophy and data science at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. He is the author of Why AI Research Needs Disabled and Marginalized Perspectives, Fitting the Description, Historical and Sociotechnical Elements of Facial Recognition and Anti-Black Surveillance, and Constructing Situated and Social Knowledge, Ethical, Sociological, and Phenomenological Factors in Technological Design. Damian is also a member of the Project Advisory Committee for the Center for Democracy and Technologies Project on Disability Rights and Algorithmic Fairness, Bias, and Discrimination, and the Disability Inclusion Fund's Tech and Disability Stream Advisory Committee. Damian Williams, thank you very much for joining us. The debate between Fetterman and Oz really seemed to focus more than anything else on some of Fetterman's challenges, his communication challenges, which seem to emerge from his stroke. What kind of message is this giving for people with disabilities and their ability to run for public office?
Thank you very much for having me on again. Fetterman's exposure within the media and online after his stroke has pretty consistently been within the light of attacking his capacity for standing for office as a whole. While not necessarily outright attacking the subtle questioning of his fitness for office or his ability to do the job, as it's often framed, is kind of constantly on the fingertips or the lips of many people who talk about Fetterman's campaign in anything but a positive light. This question, this constant asking of, is he capable of doing the job, definitely does cast the possibility of disability as a whole as kind of outside of the realm of possibility for anyone who wants to hold public office. And that's kind of shocking considering how many visibly and openly disabled people there are in public office in the United States. You know, we have prosthetics users, we have hearing aid users, we have people with low vision, number of people in higher office at the federal and the state and the local levels. The governor of Texas is a wheelchair user. These things are known, and yet in certain cases, they're not really talked about. They're not framed, they're not highlighted. And I think that Fetterman's treatment in the past several weeks, the past couple of months, shows you exactly why that is. Once they're in the framework, once they're in the center of the frame, the narrative very quickly shifts to being one of questioning whether that person is capable of doing the job. And when it is shown that they can do the job, then it also turns from that to the only counter seems to be that inspiration porn narrative of look how much they've overcome to do this job, when really it's just a matter of the person doing the job.
One thing that comes to mind with the Fetterman discourse is how much his campaign and his supporters have reassured voters, reassured news sources that this is a temporary disability. He's recovering from a stroke, but he will recover. He will be fine. When I hear that, I think, okay, are we saying that if he, if he needs a permanent accommodation for closed captioning, for example, something that, for instance, if he was hearing impaired, are we saying that he would be disqualified? So even in the process of reassuring, there is a reinforcement about whether or not people living with disabilities are qualified to hold public office.
And that is kind of kind of crucially the point, this idea that it's okay that he's disabled right now because he won't be soon, rather than taking into account the fact that any number of people could possibly become disabled by stroke, heart disease, injury, illness, any number of things at any given point in our lives. You know, there's the saying that goes around the disability community. The disability community is the only minority that anybody can join at any time, and that pretty much everyone will if they're lucky enough to live that long. This idea that it's temporary, you know, like you said, this is meant to be reassuring, but it still does the disservice of eliding the true nature of what it means to be and to become disabled, just as a human being living in the world. Fetterman asking for accommodations for helping him to visually process written information because his auditory processing is still a little bit off of what it was. It has been impaired by his stroke. That isn't just a situation that happens to people who have strokes. As you noted, you know, hard of hearing individuals for various reasons will need captioning or sign interpreters, but also those of us with ADHD can oftentimes have auditory processing challenges, and subtitles, captioning being used in video conferencing, entertainment, just used in, you know, the ability to have a caption machine in a movie theater at the live theater performances, it's increasingly in use. These things help a whole host of people make use of the general experience of living in this world in the same way that they would be able to if these accommodations were just every day. The fact that Fetterman had to ask for them, the fact that he was denied real-time transcription captioning when he asked for them, says quite a lot about what it means to be disabled in the eyes of the general public, what it means to be assumed to be capable of a job. The reassurance that he's going to get better doesn't really take into account the fact that at some point, any number of us could have an auditory processing challenge for any number of reasons.
Another issue that I've been contemplating is there certain types of disabilities that are seen as not only acceptable, but heroic. Because we certainly have had elected officials and currently do that have disabilities. I think of Bob Dole, you know, as a result of a wound in battle, John McCain, Tammy Duckworth, Dan Crenshaw, whereas the initial response of the Oz campaign when confronted with a stroke was, first of all, to blame the stroke on Fetterman, you know, right. Talked about his, you know, his eating habits, et cetera. But it certainly seems to suggest that there are certain disabilities that are heroic and other disabilities that are just debilitating.
Yes. And those that are seen as debilitating are pretty much exactly, as you said, often framed as the fault of the individual. There's this moralizing about disability and illness. And that ties fairly directly into this idea that a lot of people don't believe that disability, chronic illness are things that can happen to them. And that if it happens to someone, then it must be because they had poor diet or they had poor hygiene or they had poor behavior in any number of ways, right? Rather than recognizing, again, that by accident, illness, or circumstance of any number of types, anyone can become disabled in any number of ways at any given time. This is not a moral stance. This is the nature of being alive. We are in fallible biological frameworks, which can, for any number of varied and terrifying reasons, just decide to stop working sometimes. Like, this is not something that we get to make real choices about. We can mitigate these effects. We can forestall them, but we cannot avoid them. And that's kind of one of the things that I think bothers people so much. So they look for something to pin it on. They look for a way to turn the disability into something that's either, again, something to be overcome, something to be triumphed against, or something that they can blame on the individual who has become disabled. That way, it lets them not have to think about the fact that this could happen to them, that this could become something that they or someone they love will have to deal with at any given time. And frankly, that situation is tied very closely to the situation in which we all currently exist and have existed for the past 3 years. John Fetterman had a stroke. And one of the many things that has increased the likelihood of millions upon millions of us having strokes at any point into the future is the prevalence of COVID-19. COVID-19 is a cardiopulmonary affecting disease. It causes long-term damage to the heart and the lungs, and it increases clotting, and it increases the likelihoods of stroke. People's response to John Fetterman, to John Fetterman's experience, to John Fetterman's access needs, to John Fetterman's presentation out in the world post-stroke tells you a whole lot about what it is that they expect to be the case about themselves or other people, or what they dread might be the case about themselves or other people in the very near future. And it ties very closely, like I said, into the fact that most people don't want to have to think about exactly how much more common strokes, heart attack, heart disease, respiratory illness are becoming and will be into the foreseeable future.
Absolutely. Something that you had highlighted before that you want to address now is that no matter how this election turns out, it's going to be about John Fetterman's stroke, that if he loses the election, the overwhelming consensus, especially since he had been polling so well, is that the debate performance cost him the election, the stroke cost him the election. And then if he wins, it will be how incredible that he overcame this stroke in order to win. So I guess ultimately, it's one of the huge challenges of people living with disabilities is that the disability defines them. So what can we do about that?
One of the only things that honestly works to be done about that is to heed disabled people about their own lived experience, center them, and rather than speculating about what happens, because so often in the discourse, what's being done is to speculate about what it means to be disabled in a particular way, what it means to have a stroke, what it means to be a wheelchair user, what it means to have a prosthesis, what it means to be an amputee. These speculations are bound up with people's fear, with their preconceptions, with their pre-existing beliefs about what disability would be like for them as a presumably non-disabled person to become disabled in that way. And so they project all of this anxiety, all of these preconceived notions onto that experience. And so rather than having an honest understanding based in the experience of the people themselves, people have this assumption, this set of assumptions that leads them to believe and to think in certain ways, to cast disability as this terrible tragedy, this all-consuming, all-defining element of who and what a person's life is. Now, having a conversation with or centering the conversations and the experiences of disabled people will not 100% solve that, but it is a crucial first stage in working towards a better understanding of the fullness of what it means to be disabled in the world and to thinking of disabled people as full and complete people, and not simply thinking of them as the site, the living locus of your anxieties about what might happen to you in the world as time goes on or as you age or any number of things.
One thing that really struck me then about the way in which the question of accommodation was framed was the way in which Oz's supporters, critics of Fetterman, almost seemed to suggest that by asking for closed captioning, that it was unfair. He was asking for an advantage that others don't have because they haven't asked for that accommodation. A reminder about how much access being guaranteed for persons with disabilities is framed around giving them special treatment as opposed to fair access. Just to give you an opportunity to respond to that observation.
Yeah, no, and that's absolutely correct. But one of the interesting things about that is that if you invert that supposition, if you invert the unfair access supposition, what you get instead is the fact that disability access accommodations raise the bar for everyone, right? They decrease barriers for entry for everyone. If that gives him an unfair advantage than if everyone has the capability to read the transcripts at the same time as hearing the audio or having another mode or mechanism of processing available for themselves, whatever that may be, then what that does is it truly levels the playing field and it makes the entire experience accessible to a wider range of people. It's not unfair treatment. It's a realm of treatment. It's a range of treatment. It's a framing of treatment that allows everyone to actually access the space. It allows everyone to actually participate. That's what it actually does.
So with that, we have been discussing the ways in which the Fetterman campaign and the Fetterman-Oz debate have been framed around ableist assumptions, ableist presumptions, and what it means to give full access for people with disabilities to public office and so many other areas of public service. Our guest today has been Damian Patrick Williams, assistant professor in philosophy and data science at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. He is the author of Why AI Research Needs Disabled and Marginalized Perspectives, Fitting the Description, Historical and Socio-Technical Elements of Facial Recognition and Anti-Black Surveillance, and Constructing Situated and Social Knowledge, Ethical, Sociological, and Phenomenological Factors in Technological Design. He is also member of the Project Advisory Committee for the Center for Democracy and Technology's Project on Disability Rights and Algorithmic Fairness, Bias, and Discrimination, and the Disability Inclusion Fund's Tech and Disability Stream Advisory Committee. Thank you very much for joining us.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org. And our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.